Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Unauthorized Disclosure Podcast. I'm Kevin Gastola, and I'm joined by Rania Kalik. Hey, Rania.
Hey, Kevin.
And we're very pleased to be joined by Gareth Porter, who is an award-winning investigative journalist. He was given the 2012 Gellhorn Prize. He's covered national security issues and foreign policy, U.S. military, since 2005. He's the author of Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare, which came out in 2014. His works appeared at Salon, The Nation, Consortium News, as well as other outlets. Thank you, Gareth, for joining us.
Hi, Kevin. Hi, Rania. Thanks for having me on.
So let's get right to it. We're having you on the show to talk about what's happening with Iran and the Trump administration, and we'll get into the attitudes and opinions that Donald Trump has expressed about war versus what his own administration officials like Mike Pompeo and John Bolton seem to believe and feel about Iran and the sort of acts of aggression. As we're doing the show and we're recording, it's Thursday, June 20th, just so people have a marker. I imagine that a lot is going to develop in the next 72 hours by the time the show is posted, so I just put that out there. And I know you're working on a longer piece that people will eventually be able to look for that you'll share, and we'll share as well. And it digs into this, but we really wanted to begin first off with the incident that happened several days ago in the Gulf of Oman, this incident with a tanker attack, and have you sort of set up what is happening here and where you believe this is all going, because there's a lot of information out there about what allegedly happened, or the media has jumped onto this like they do when there's a push for war without questioning intelligence. And we wanted to have you on to help us sort out some of what was the truth and what wasn't.
Well, I really appreciate your inviting me to do that. And just to set the frame for this whole discussion, this is certainly one of the most difficult, complex problems to unpack that I have ever seen in, you know, several decades of observing U.S. wars and crises that have to do with intelligence. And the reason, I think, is that we have it's kind of like murder on the Orient Express, okay? It's a situation where both Iran and Israel and its American allies have strong motives for mounting an operation such as this. And the question, I mean, one of the questions that I have pondered is, you know, whose interests are primarily served, or whose interests are served most clearly and most strongly by what happened in the Sea of Oman, where the Japanese Kokuka, I believe I got it right, although I keep getting confused about it, Kokuka Courageous and a Norwegian boat were both apparently sabotaged or hit by mines that were above the waterline and therefore clearly not intended to sink the boats, but merely to disable them temporarily and have a political effect. And the point that I would make here is that although both sides of this conflict in the Middle East have a reasonably strong motive, the effect of this pair of attacks clearly is more beneficial politically to the Israeli and U.S. war hawk side of the equation than it is to the Iranian government, and that's because on one hand, the mines, presuming that it was a limpet mine in both cases, the mines did not really have the effect of stopping or even in a major way preventing all of the boats that the ships that are going to be using the Strait of Hormuz from going ahead with their plans. There's no sign that is going to happen or could have been the effect of these limpet mines. And so on the other hand, it really provides, more fuel for the war hawks in the United States to push their line, their interest getting support for and getting Trump support for a U.S. attack on Iran. Now, so that's the big picture. That doesn't mean that it's impossible that the IRGC did in fact mount this operation. But I think the evidence is sufficiently vague, is sufficiently unclear at this point, that we still have to be very cautious about assigning the responsibility for it. And that's the overview that I would start with.
And what would you say to people who express maybe concerns I won't be vague. I realize that when this was reported, there were meetings going on with Shinzo Abe of Japan, and this sort of diplomacy would appear to me as against the interests of the U.S. or, let's say, Israel, if you didn't really want diplomacy to rule the day. We know that the Trump administration deplores that as a strategy or a way of handling Iran because they've already backed out and trashed the nuclear deal. And so it seems like their interest is to maintain tension. So I'm just wondering why Iran, or you've contemplated the issue of why Iran would do this while they were meeting with Japanese officials.
Right. I mean, this is a key question. And again, I mean, I don't think that it's an easy question to answer. And that's because what Abe was taking with him was a message from Trump that was clearly not going to be a message that the Iranian government could say, yes, we're interested in responding to this positively. And in fact, as we know, the Supreme Leader made it clear that this was unacceptable and that Iran was not going to give any sort of positive response, that this was simply a continuation of the status quo policy of the United States, which was essentially based on an act of war, as the Iranians see it, and objectively that has to be regarded as a reasonable, not just reasonable, but an accurate way of describing what the United States is doing in cutting off Iran's access to the world's oil markets, and this, you know, is the equivalent, in a way, of what the United States did before World War II with regard to Japan. I mean, in this case, it was cutting off the selling of oil rather than the buying of oil, but it has the same effect of cutting off the lifeline, the economic lifeline, that Iran depends on to maintain an economy that can serve the people's interests, and so you know, I think it's unclear precisely how to interpret the relationship between the fact that Abe was there diplomatically, bringing diplomatic note from I don't know if you want to call it a diplomatic note, but a note from Trump. Inviting Iran to sit down with him to talk about, you know, making a new deal to replace the JCPOA, which is simply a non-starter. So I don't know if we can reach any conclusion about that. You know, in one way, you know, it could be viewed from one angle. It could be viewed as the Israelis taking advantage of an event that would make it look more like an Iranian act of sabotage of diplomacy. On the other hand, it could be viewed as the Americans and the Israelis. As Iran rejecting an approach and choosing that as the moment to do it. I'm not sure. I think that this is a remarkably ambiguous situation of, regarding the circumstances in which it took place.
You know, Gareth, I think there's like a few things that I find really dangerous about what's happening right now. Obviously, like, this is in the context of some serious escalation against Iran from the U.S. with the sort of like Armageddon Brigade of John Bolton and Mike Pompeo leading the charge. But, you know, with what happened in the Gulf, I mean, you know, we can start, it's like speculate, we can speculate a lot about what could have been. But what I do find concerning is you have a situation where there's two things happening. One, you have Mike Pompeo and John Bolton stating this case of, at this point, anything that is done by what they consider to be Iranian proxies in the region that hurts U.S. interests is now a provocation that can be used as a pretext to go to war against Iran. And so, of course, like what they mean by that, it's such a vague statement, but that means that, you know, all of these forces across the Middle East that have relationships and partnerships with Iran, whether it be these militias in Iraq or Hezbollah in Lebanon or the Houthis in Yemen. And of course, like, I disagree with the idea that these are all proxies of Iran. But regardless, these groups, anything that they do, whether it's, you know, the Houthis against Saudi Arabia or Hezbollah and Israel exchanging fire, or a militia in Iraq that's close to Iran that accidentally gets too close to like an American base, suddenly this becomes an attack on the U.S. by Iran, and it's a pretext for war. So that's one issue that I find so dangerous. I'd love to hear your thoughts on, because this means, and then the media tends to go with it, right? That whenever this happens, the media like does say, oh, the Iran-backed Houthis in Yemen attacked Saudi Arabia. And then that opens up room for John Bolton to then say, well, that's cause for war. They attacked an American ally. So there's that. And then the other issue is with these kinds of things happening in the Gulf that are really fishy and strange. And of course, anything is possible. That said, you do have groups like the MEK, this cultish group that's backed by the U.S. and apparently also Saudi Arabia and has a relationship with the Israelis. It then opens up room for like a group like that to just like do something that's sabotaging an oil tanker if they wanted to, if they have the capability to. I'm not sure they do, but technically they could do that. And then the U.S. immediately blames it on Iran, and that's another pretext for war. So I guess, could you speak to those two things? And this might be shoving in too much, but no, it's just no. This administration is going from so many angles to try and like, to try and come up with some sort of pretext for a war with Iraq. That the other issue is now you've got this situation, the sideshow, where you've got the, you know, Mike Pompeo and John Bolton insisting that Iran is collaborating and has ties with Al-Qaeda, and that this means that the AUMF from 2001 now applies to war on Iran. So I guess my point is we seem to be in this really, really dangerous moment where anything could trigger a war. And so what are your thoughts on all that?
Well, you're absolutely right. This is the most dangerous moment thus far. There's no doubt in my mind about that. And I couldn't agree more that what Bolton and Pompeo have been doing, and this started last September. It's not just in May that they began this campaign that was aimed at finding a pretext for war with Iran in any incident that involved an ally of Iran in the Middle East. It's an insidious plot that should be unmasked by the media, but you're right, the media have been absolutely uncritical thus far. I cannot think of a single piece in corporate media coverage that has raised any questions about that line that Pompeo and Bolton have put forward. And, you know, let's go back to where it started just for a moment. In September 2018, this was in the context of protest in Basra, a major Shiite city in the south of Iraq, where protesters were in the streets by the thousands, violent protests that took place for days and days, and in which the protesters burned down the Iranian consulate, burned the offices of pro-Iranian militias that were supported by Iran that were fighting ISIS, burned down the offices of pro-Iranian parties and political organizations in Iraq, and tried to shut down the only seaport that Iraq has, which is on the outskirts of Basra. Now, it was in conjunction with those violent protests in which many protesters were killed by security forces, that rockets were fired at the Basra airport late at night, and where the U.S. consulate is located, at the Basra airport. And it was not close to the U.S. consulate, but it was in the security perimeter of the Basra airport. And that was treated by Pompeo and Bolton as a threat to the U.S. consulate. Well, logically speaking, of course, it had nothing to do with the U.S. consulate. It was part of a protest against Iran and its allies in Iraq. That same night, one or more rockets, not clear, there are different reports, were fired into the Green Zone in Baghdad, where, the U.S. embassy is located. And this was, if I remember correctly, September 6th, 2018. Now, you have to understand that the protests in Basra had spread to Baghdad. There were people who were protesting in sympathy with the protest in Basra at that point. And so, all of these rockets that were fired logically cannot be considered to be somehow a politically motivated by pro-Iranian forces. It's exactly the opposite. But Pompeo and Bolton got away with having played it that way because nobody questioned that in the press. So that's the background, really, of May 5th, when Bolton comes out with this one-paragraph statement from the White House saying exactly what Rania just said in summary, that is that any incident that involves a threat to U.S. personnel or interests or allies in the region will be treated as an Iranian act of war, and the United States will retaliate directly against Iran. Now that's what was said by Pompeo and Bolton in September and October of 2018. They initially put forward that principle of policy in response to what had happened in Basra and Baghdad. So now they're repeating it again in May 5th, and this is in the context of what we now know was a meeting between the Israelis and Trump administration national security officials, with Bolton as national security advisor leading the American delegation in the White House on April 15th, in which Mossad passed on a very detailed set of scenarios for how the United States and Israel might respond to threats from Iran, threats which they imagined might take place. And this then gives rise to all these stories about various kinds of scenarios with Iran putting missiles on boats in the area of the Strait of Hormuz, the Sea of Oman, etc., threatening to use missiles against U.S. facilities and allies in the region, particularly in Iraq. So there's a logical connection here between this agreement that was reached in December of 2017, reported by the top Israeli national security correspondent Barak Ravid in Axios, as well as in Israeli newspapers or Israeli television, that would constitute a working group to continue to meet and come up with joint approaches to dealing with Iran. and the current crisis. This is a crisis, I am quite sure, that relates to and is stemming from close U.S.-Israeli cooperation. I'm quite sure about that, because that is what was reflected in the May 5th Bolton statement. So I think that there is a direct connection here between the current crisis as ginned up by Bolton and Pompeo, the threat of war, which now, of course, we know that Trump has said he's not going to go along with, but the threat of war ginned up by Bolton and Pompeo, and this background that relates to very close cooperation between the United States and Israel, an understanding about how they would try to respond to an imagined situation involving Iran.
I mean, there's a couple like more larger contextual questions that need to be asked, but I want to make sure before we get too much farther in our conversation that you just comment on the breaking news of today. And what you think, I mean, maybe the basic thing is that it just adds to the tension and allows for more escalation. But your comment on the fact that Iran shot down a U.S. military drone over Iran, and that now universally the media is, you know, of course, putting the blame and responsibility on Iran as if they, you know, shouldn't defend their territory from our advances.
Right. I mean, this is one of the dimensions of this crisis that makes it so dangerous, that what we now have is drones on both sides, drones from the United States, as well as from Iran, involved in every part of the Middle East that could be affected by the conflict. Both, you know, Iranian territory and the waters that Iran has, obviously the large territorial waters in the Strait of Hormuz and that area, and other places, the war between Yemen and Saudi Arabia and the UAE, there are drones that are involved in that war as well. This makes it much more dangerous, because we've already seen that both sides are trying to shoot down the drones on the other side. And that has already been treated by Israel as a pretext for attacks in Syria against Iranian and Syrian forces there. And this is clearly one of the ways in which this crisis can erupt into a tit-for-tat exchange of fire and a serious war, no question about it. I mean, I think that is worth registering, and it means that it is even more urgent than it would be otherwise for people who are conscious of the underlying problems that we've begun to discuss here, that there is a need to get analysis and commentary that clarifies this background as fast and as furiously as possible.
And then, Gareth, could you comment on the ties? I'll give a specific example, but the fact that there is a political difference between this administration and Obama's administration that is significant, even though there's continuity within the military-industrial complex or the national security establishment. We have seen that this administration has allowed figures, particularly from think tanks like the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, to populate its ranks. I believe that's where John Bolton had done a lot of his work. And then also they've added Richard Goldberg, who has joined the National Security Council. There's another official that came from, and this is a think tank that has been against the nuclear deal and has even gone so far as to agitate for the Trump administration to provoke unrest within Iran. So this is a much different sort of cast of characters that we have than with the Obama administration.
That's absolutely right, of course. I mean, what the Trump administration represents, in effect, is an alliance with Israel against Iran that goes up to the brink of war, from the beginning. But that's the starting point. In other words, it is based on the whole idea that the United States will challenge Iran in ways that are that are inevitably going to bring the United States towards the brink of war. And of course, the fact that you have two figures in Pompeo and Bolton, both of whom, for different reasons, are committed to the point of view that the United States should entertain the idea of being ready to go to war with Iran. Pompeo is, of course, a believer in the rapture. And people understand what that means. It's that, you know, he believes that a kind of final end to history would take place in the Middle East, in present day Israel, that would usher in the entry of all saved souls into heaven. And of course, Jews and Islamic Muslims need not apply. But that is a firm belief, and he's talked about it publicly. Bolton, of course, has been aligned with the most extreme elements in Israel for decades now, and has been rewarded for his service to Israel by the Zionist Organization of America, not just once, but twice. And has, of course, openly called for bombing Iran for the last decade before he went into his present position as national security advisor. So, I mean, you could hardly imagine a more dangerous situation from that point of view. And the Obama administration, as weak as its policy was toward Iran and wrong-headed in the sense that it accepted what I have documented in my book, Manufactured Crisis, was a false narrative that Iran had been trying to get nuclear weapons, had a policy of trying to procure nuclear weapons in a covert nuclear weapons program. And based on that belief, negotiated a deal that was implicitly accepting the idea that Iran had to be pressured to accept limits on its program, otherwise it was going to get nuclear weapons. And that has been so widely accepted now that let's face it, I mean, we face a situation where Iran now is going to move back to enrichment levels that will trigger a new level of crisis between Iran and the United States. So, I mean, that is still the problem that lurks. It's no longer in the background. It's coming to the foreground now, but it's going to be the center of a new level of crisis in the coming weeks, because Iran will, in fact, make public statements in the very near future that it is going to move back to a level of enrichment that will be viewed officially by the U.S. government as moving towards nuclear weapons.
What do you make of what appears to be a split in the administration at the moment? And when I say split, I mean Trump on one side and literally the rest of the administration that he's stacked with neocons on the other. It's kind of scary. It seems like Trump is like our last hope for avoiding an actual war at this point.
Well, I'm glad you asked.
He seems to be very much against it. Yeah.
I was waiting for you to ask that question, because that's what we need to add to this picture. It's the only slender hope that we have at this point that somehow the truth can get through to Trump, that he can use to get his war hawks under control. Because you're right. I mean, you know, what happened, you know, over the past week and more is that Pompeo and Bolton successfully mounted, with the support of CENTCOM, the Central Command, and the Pentagon, a campaign that clearly pinned the responsibility for the attacks in the Gulf on Iran, and moved towards a war crisis. There were briefings that Pompeo talked about publicly, in which apparently, according to a report in an Israeli newspaper by sourced to a sympathetic diplomat at the UN who clearly was in touch with people involved in the Pompeo Pompeo-Bolton group meetings, or was made aware of them, involved a discussion of a scenario that was an attack on an Iranian target that had to do with its nuclear program. That was at least one of, if not the main scenario that was discussed as an option if this crisis continued to go forward. But of course, we know that Trump did not agree with that option. Apparently, he made it clear in the briefing that he would not approve of that option. And the Israeli report about this said explicitly that Trump did not approve it, but was upset by what the Iranians did. This was the effect of the report, saying that Trump was upset enough that they hoped, or that they believed, that Trump would allow Pompeo to have what he wanted. So that was the way it was described in this Israeli report. But in any case, Pompeo was clearly hoping, along with Bolton, that they could continue to press ahead with talking about war options. And there was a briefing with members of Congress, apparently members of the House Intelligence Committee, last week, on a day in a place that was not specified, in which Pompeo said that he believed that they could use the AUMF, the Authorization for the Use of Military Force of 2001, to attack Iran. And of course, there were challenges by some members saying, well, that's not really true. We haven't given any authorization, and there's no reason to believe that Congress would approve of that. And Pompeo was apparently unmoved and was still taking that position. So this is a very serious element of the crisis. But now Trump came out in this Time magazine interview with a clear statement, could hardly be clearer, that he will not go to war over the attacks that did take place the previous week, nor any other attacks similar to that. He, in fact, minimized their importance, calling them very minor, and made it clear that this was not the casus belli from his point of view. And he reserved that for evidence that Iran was getting a nuclear weapon. Now, of course, that's a formula that could mean anything from, you know, starting to enrich uranium at a certain level, a certain amount of uranium, to waiting until there was actual evidence of a work on a nuclear weapon itself, the actual design of a nuclear weapon or something like that, having actual evidence or intelligence of that. So there is a clear distinction between Trump's position and the position of the war hawks in his administration. But you're right. I mean, you know, it's Trump against virtually the rest of the administration. He doesn't have any allies. And so what we have here is a dangerous dynamic in which Pompeo and Bolton, and particularly Pompeo, apparently feels free to speak out and continue to spout his line, which he did on Tuesday, the day, the same day in the afternoon that the Time magazine interview was published. So that shows you that Pompeo is not necessarily going to shut up. In fact, it suggests the opposite. And so I think what we see here is a repeat of the same dynamic that we've seen before, where Trump takes a position, for example, on Syria, where he said on two occasions that he wanted to pull all U.S. troops out. And then there was a lull when nothing was happening. But finally, he was induced to change his mind and allowed the troops to stay, or at least most of them to stay, a lot of them to stay. And so we have this dynamic where you cannot count on Trump sticking by his guns. And so that makes it really necessary to find a way to get somebody that Trump listens to or believes in to pass on to him information that strengthens his resolve. Perhaps Rand Paul, who's been talking to him, plays golf with him, could fulfill that function. Who knows? But I think that's the one thing, the slender hope that we can look to salvage the situation, to prevent Pompeo and Bolton from carrying on with their very insidious strategy.
Jesus Christ, the fate of the future depends on Donald Trump, possibly Rand Paul, and Tucker Carlson.
Yeah. We need Glenn Greenwald to go on Tucker Carlson.
Well, also Tucker himself. Tucker's against war on Iran. In between his segments on why liberals don't let people have handshakes anymore. I'm no joke. One time I watched Tucker Carlson do a really great segment on why we shouldn't be doing regime change in Venezuela. But it came after a segment on handshakes. I kid you not. So it's like, these are the people that we have to depend on to hopefully prevent a war. It's a really, really scary situation.
So Gareth, I wanted to make sure we mention before we wrap the show the issue of the economic sanctions that have been in place and that regime, just because I think I see it as serving the same function as really the sanctions that are imposed on Venezuela, especially, and that's out there. But I suppose the more crucial question and the last thing that I really have for this interview, and then Rania can add whatever after you answer this, is we recall back in the mid-2000s that there was this interest, or we saw or heard this drumbeat for a potential war with Iran. There were many anti-war activists that took it quite seriously. I recall that there were several municipalities here in Chicago, where I'm based. There was even a small group that got the city council to start considering a resolution where they would endorse no war against Iran. It didn't really succeed, but it was something that had a grassroots effort behind it. And so it was really a distinct possibility that after Iraq, we could go to war with Iran. But I always knew that at the time, it seemed like the U.S. military was very reluctant because of what it would mean as far as an entanglement, the risk to U.S. troops and the sort of resources that would be required for a war with Iran. It seemed to discourage them back in the mid-2000s. So I'm wondering share your perspective on what a war with Iran would look like in 2020. Is it still very similar? Is there anything that's changed within the military institution that would lead us to believe they don't have the same view that they had back in the mid-2000s?
The answer is basically nothing has happened that would change the Pentagon general framework of analyzing or approaching this problem, which is that we don't want to go to war with Iran. And in fact, I'm quite sure that feeling within the Pentagon would be now very much stronger than it was in 2007, when, by the way, most people are not aware of the fact that the Pentagon did, in fact, sit on a squash, if you will, or quash, perhaps is a better word, a proposal by Vice President Dick Cheney that was made within the principals group of senior officials in national security to retaliate if there were an incident in Iraq in which American personnel were killed that could be blamed on Iran, that the United States should retaliate against a military target, an IRGC, Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps target in Iran. And the Pentagon was the lead in basically saying, okay, well, how would that end up? Show us what the tit for tat would be next, and then after that, and then after that, and what the endpoint would be. And the answers were obviously not forthcoming or were not acceptable, and so it died. And I think we have a similar dynamic that would occur in a serious discussion, even today, of a war between the United States and Iran. And the reason is because Iran has far more capable, more capabilities to hit U.S. naval power in the Gulf, in the Persian Gulf area, and indeed to hit U.S. ground bases in Qatar, naval base in Bahrain, and other ground bases in the region. So so the U.S. stake here is even greater today. The challenge, the threat to U.S. military interests in the Middle East are much greater today, or measurably greater, let me put it that way, than they were in 2007. And so I think it's safe to say that the Pentagon and most of the military, the Air Force might be a possible exception to that, would be opposed to going to war with Iran. Now, does that mean that it's impossible? I'm not sure, because I don't know enough about the guy, Mike Esper, who is supposed to be now in line to become the new Secretary of Defense. But the Secretary of Defense does make the decision officially, and the military, unless top-ranking military people are ready to quit their jobs and create a crisis, then that is going to be the policy. So I think we have to wait and see to find out more about that person's position. At this point, I don't know what it is.
Do you have anything else for him, Rania?
No, I mean, that would have been my last question, too, is what would a war with Iran look like? But I think I think we've kind of, oh, sorry, go ahead, Garrett.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I forgot to address the question about the sanctions, which just to make a final comment about that, I just want to repeat and emphasize the point that I made at the outset, which is that what these sanctions that the Trump administration have done and are doing is to threaten the Iranian economy in a way that is unprecedented, except for the case of the pre-World War II or the pre-war in the Pacific, U.S. Basically taking military action to prevent Japan from being able to obtain oil that it needed to run its industries. And so I think one needs to think about these sanctions against Iran as a similar act of war, because it really is. And we're going to hear more about this in the coming weeks, because, again, Iran is going to take actions that will raise once again the issue of this threat of war by the United States in response to what Iran is going to do with regard to its nuclear program. And again, the crisis in the Gulf is not over as well. I mean, Iran may well make decisions to take action that would be regarded by the United States as a basis for going to war with Iran. by the Trump administration. So issue of the United States basically carrying out the equivalent of an act of war against Iran is at the center of this war crisis. And I think people need to be much more sensitive to that and really study and talk about the implications of that fact more than has been the case up to now.
All right. Well, thank you, Gareth. We really appreciate you joining us to talk about this important topic. And once again, for people, you published the book Manufactured Crisis, Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare. And your work has appeared at Salon, The Nation, Consortium News, and other outlets. And we'll be sharing your piece on what has happened and transpired in the last week or so when it is posted. We'll have it go out along with this episode, which should be available on the 23rd, on June 23rd.
Well, thank you so much, Kevin and Rania. I really appreciate your interest in discussing this issue and what I have to say about it.
And right on cue, on June 22nd, after we recorded the show, it was reported that President Trump called off military strikes on Iran because he was concerned the loss of life would not be proportionate to Iran downing an unmanned U.S. military drone. It pretty much proves that we were on the right track here about Donald Trump being our last and only hope, which is both sad confirmation and troubling because you don't know how long he's going to be able to withstand the hawks in his administration. But he openly recognized that John Bolton is very hawkish on this matter, didn't suggest that John Bolton should leave his administration as a national security advisor, which is probably the most troubling aspect of all this. But again, this happened after we recorded the show. Thank you for listening. I want to thank our patrons, all 200 plus of you. We really appreciate your continued support. If you enjoyed the interview with Gareth Porter and would like to support the show, go to patreon.com/unauthorizeddisclosure, patreon.com/unauthorizeddisclosure. You can become a patron. You can unlock this episode early. You can unlock future episodes early. You can get access to exclusive content as we post it in the coming months. And there are all sorts of other perks that we like to offer in order to build a community around this show. So thank you for listening to this week's Unauthorized Disclosure episode. We'll be back next week with another show.
You are listening to AWOL Radio here on 102.7 CKMS Radio Waterloo, radiowaterloo.ca, broadcasting to all of Waterloo Region.
Today we have a quick interview with longtime organizer and political activist Julian Ickham, based in Kitchener, Ontario. This interview was first aired on AWOL Radio on May 10th, 2019. Here today with Julian Ickham, who was just in court. We're going to get an update about current legal situation Julian faces. Julian, could you give us a little update on what happened and maybe a little background on what these charges are?
Basically, at this point in time, I'm facing several charges for false identification and fraud. These charges stem from an arrest in January, where there are allegations that I tried to cash a check that was not in my name using false identification. This check allegedly did not hurt anyone other than the banks. As a prequel, we've been running a tent city and spending about $100 a day feeding people and doing the job of the city. As well, myself and other people have been denied medication due to the high cost of medication and other things. What the Crown is alleging is that these checks were being used to finance my medication as well as the tent city. the reality of the situation is I did not put one penny in my pocket. And if poor people need to resort to these tactics to feed themselves, I see nothing morally wrong. The banks themselves, such as the Royal Bank and Bank of Montreal, create student loans and student debts for tens of thousands of dollars for like young individuals, many of them who end up defaulting and ending working crappy jobs or no jobs at all and having their money, particularly their taxes, seized. So in many ways, what they are accusing me of is Robin Hood style tactics, taking from the thieves and redistributing to those who have none. This falls under necessity. People are freezing to death on the streets. People are starving to death and people are dying because of lack of medication. If the truth be told, and if I resorted to these methods, which I'm neither confirming or denying, it was because of the necessity that we cannot allow people to freeze to death while corporations are making money, creating poverty.
So today in court, in the Waterloo Regional Courthouse,
I started to make my arguments and the judge dismissed me. Some of the charges were removed and a court hearing will be set up 3 weeks from now with a judge who has jurisdiction to rule on these.
Also in Waterloo Region?
Yes. The reality is that every day at our safe injection site, we treat about 30, 40 people. I would say we deal with about 10 overdoses a day. Many times we don't have the necessary equipment and any funding that comes from whatever means to finance this equipment, such as an naloxone, which they only give you one at the Shoppers. And the social services have been getting theirs cut. Sanguine this week has had a very big shortage of naloxone as well as clean needles. I think it's important that funds be secured by any means necessary to save lives. And if the city isn't going to save lives and allow people to die on the streets, if the city is going to allow people to starve to death and sleep in tents in the last few months has been like zero or less, risking pneumonia as well as other things, any and all means need to be done to make sure that people live.
Why don't we talk about the tent city a little more and some of the organizing that's going on in town to stem this?
The tent city was started last year. We've been negotiating with over a year for the city to give us two buildings, one to be used by addicts, which would have safe injection site, which would have programs similar to methadone, but instead use heroin, which people are using anyways, to wean people off, harm reduction, as well as ways for people to fit in. The other would be to create alternatives to drugs, such as cultural events, teaching people to play guitar, that sort of thing. The city reneged on this, so we set it up ourselves. We set up two tent cities, one for users, one without users. And we've been financing this ourselves. We've been serving two meals a day to over 100 people, which comes to about $200 a day, which is a lot of financing. We've been getting people into homes since the original tent city. I would say 70% of people have been acquiring low-income housing because of the pressure. Our other program is a safe injection site, which we've been running for about 2 months now. People come, feel a safe place to use, and if they overdose, we bring them back. We teach people how to use naloxone. We're certified trainers, and we train people and certify them. So all these programs save lives, and all these programs are not financed by the city. These people are going to die.
How can people support these, like these kind of actions, the tent cities, the ongoing overdose prevention sites or the safe injection sites?
Two things. They can write letters to the members of parliament saying how this is necessary. And the other thing is they can make donations. Donations are very important. The reality of the situation is we can't, with the heat and everything, we can't just finance these through other means. And people can contact me at my Facebook, Julian Theodore Ickham, if they would like to make donations. I would have to say about 75% of my time on Facebook is hitting up people for donations. So if people want to make donations, that would be really cool.
There was a little encouraging news recently. Maybe you could react to the city and the region coming together, picking a spot for a safe injection site 9 months from now, with an opening date as long as it's funded.
See, this is an issue. This has been promised 2 years ago, and they've been dragging their feet. The city of Cambridge has been mobilizing the most reactionary elements, not only to protest this, but to also attack the current safe injection sites. I myself have been jumped and attacked several times. You can see all the scratches on my hands and other bruises from getting into fights. Our tents have been kicked and other things. It's really important that people take a stand and show that this is important. But 9 months from now, how many people are going to die? I think it's been since January about 40 deaths. Those numbers will just increase, so people need to support what's on the ground now and push for something quicker than 9 months. 9 months is too long.
I felt when I saw that 9 months as the opening date for this location, I felt that, you know, wasn't really an adequate response to the crisis that exists. Wasn't there talk about like getting a temporary site going? Do you have any?
There was talk, but that's been squashed. So we've been doing the temporary site for now.
And that's kind of how I've seen it. Is the city has seen that you're operating a site, a very grassroots site, and they're like, "Oh, that'll do for another nine months."
They weren't even doing anything before that. We only did that because, like, they were saying people can wait 9 months, and it's not a solution. It's two tents and people trained in it, trying to stuff people in these tents to have a safer place to do it. Any sort of like, "Well, we have this now," is kind of like a little too late. If they really did think that this was important, they'd be financing it instead of letting people like myself go up on charges around this.
Now, could there be, are there kind of immediately implementable solutions, short-term solutions, until the main site gets in? Is there something that could come in the short term?
First, the city can finance us. Second of all, they can set up a trailer, take some nurses from the health department, and do it up.
Mm-hmm. I've seen many times just the economic argument that it costs way more to continuously treat people for all the problems associated with overdosing, including death,
yeah.
than just to run these sites. Yet they're not running these sites even, you know, "Oh, we need provincial money to do this."
It's a moral issue. They think, like, the reason why methadone is being so encouraged is people believe the myth that methadone doesn't get you high, which is not true at all. But the idea is that if people get any sort of pleasure out of it, this is bad. So it's some sort of moral issue that, you know, these people need to suffer and they need to hit rock bottom. And they need to be horrible. Meanwhile, while politicians are shoving their nose up with coke and stuff, they turn their blind eye to all of this. You know, so it is a bit of a hypocrisy, especially with Doug Ford. I was going to say Drug Ford.
We've got over that one.
Money and is now trying to consolidate his power by criminalizing drug users. The reality is that the drugs need to be handed out by the city to addicts, so they don't need to resort to criminality.
Anything else you wanted to add on this? How people can support? How people can support your
thing, as well as write to members of city council and the region. Hit them up.
The city and the region. Yeah. So we'll get some of those contact information up on the website, grandrivermc.ca, and that's Kitchener City Council, Waterloo City Council, Cambridge City Council, and of course the region, the regional government as well. All need to be continuously pushed, even though they've baby steps forward, they need to be pushed to make sure there's some immediate solutions to the issues that are, I don't want to say plaguing.
Well, it is. These issues are plaguing our community. Right. People are dying because people make moral choices that say that you're less than human. Therefore, you have to go to the street and get ripped off and probably die.
All right, the issues that are plaguing this community. And that was our interview with longtime organizer and political activist Julian Ickham. Check out julianickham.wordpress.com for more information about